The Bible says that there's something broken about human nature. Something is just off. And that means the world that we live in doesn't work in the way that it could. It doesn't work in the way that it was meant to. I have to admit to you something I'm a little bit embarrassed about, but I've been watching some old Judge Judy episodes on YouTube. Anybody not know what I'm talking about? Yeah, maybe not. She was the highest paid television personality of all time. Do you know that? She made more money than anybody else ever made on television. They just came. One episode just showed up on my feed. I don't know how. And then all of a sudden, you watch one, and what happens? You get another one, right? So, and what's been fascinating to me about the court cases that she deals with is the utter and complete selfishness of people. It's just staggering, really, to watch it. And there's also a basic inability to truly see outside of themselves, people in the episode. And it would be tempting to simply dismiss this kind of television as sensationalism if it weren't for the nagging sense that the selfishness that one finds in Judge Judy episodes has something to do with the wars we see going on in the world around us today. That selfishness has something to do with the crime we hear about in the news or the environmental degradation that we sometimes run across. And the basic Christian claim is that the crucifixion, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ is God's critical element for his rescue plan for the world. See, God has a rescue plan for the world, and it's to rescue us from ourselves and our innate selfishness and self-centeredness. And God intends to give people a new human nature. We talked a bit about this at the early service, at the sunrise service. A human nature that's rooted in divine love, joy, and peace. And a new human nature that will lead to full partnership with God and full equanimity with people. True partnership with people, too. And that's what I would like to talk to you about today. How about how God brings a new human nature to us in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I just have one problem, though, and that is I suspect many of you have doubts about Jesus' resurrection. Some of you may have major doubts about Jesus' resurrection. That means any insight that I offer to you about God, what God's up to in Jesus Christ, about what God's up to in raising Jesus from the dead, is kind of pointless if you don't believe in the resurrection itself. It seems to me, at least in some ways, that what I would be saying is a waste of time. And I want to suggest to you, it's completely understandable to have doubts and real hesitation about Jesus' resurrection, whether you are a seeker, a new Christian, or a long-term church attender. Why wouldn't you have doubts? I was talking about this at the sunrise service, but I did make a little scale for us. Imagine 0 is total disbelief in Jesus' resurrection, and 10 is complete total belief. Where would you put yourself on that continuum? And understand that people move up and down this continuum all the time. It's not that we stay at one place on it. We're moving up and down on it based on our experiences, based on the realities that we're dealing with in life, based on how connected we feel with God and with Christ himself. No one ever stays in one spot, truly. And I remember singing this Bach cantata on the resurrection in the prestigious choir at the University of Toronto. I had this opportunity to sing in this really phenomenal choir, and we sang this beautiful cantata, and it was about the resurrection of Jesus, and in that moment when we were singing this music, and I had this music experience also singing the Hallelujah Chorus of having complete and total insight and belief in the resurrection of Jesus. I knew what it was about. I knew it was real. It was true. It was powerful. It had an immediate sense to it. I had a wonder and an understanding of it. And in that moment of singing this wonderful music, I also recognized that I would forget what I knew. And so I had to remember that I once knew what the total meaning of the resurrection of Jesus Christ was. And there was not one shred of doubt as I was singing that music. But one of the challenges we all face in believing in Jesus' resurrection is our uniform experience in life, the dead bodies stay dead. I mean, that's our uniform experience. A body that's been dead for hours or days never comes back to life for us. That's our uniform experience. And when a religion claims that its founder has been raised from the dead, raised from the grave to new life, in a tangible and recognizable manner, it's completely understandable that people will be skeptical about this kind of claim. All I would suggest to you is understand this skepticism is not new. It goes right from modern, it's not new to modern people. It's not something we invented for ourselves. It goes right back to the very origins of the Christian faith when the earlier followers of Jesus took the message of Messiah Jesus, crucified and raised from the dead. They took it out into their world. And immediately they ran into the hard wall of ancient skepticism. And I want to show you a very short video from a scholar, N.T. Wright, who's one of the probably handful of leading New Testament scholars in the world. I want to just a two-minute video about his thinking about the kind of challenges the early church faced in sharing their message to the world.
There is something surprising and very bold at the heart of Christianity, the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. Say more about that. suppose somebody says, look, give me a break. That doesn't happen. I gather at one recent debate on this, someone brought in a nurse who had said, listen, you've been in hospitals, you've seen people die. Have they ever come back? and so on. And so how do you respond to the initial skepticism that someone may have of, how could that possibly be?
Well, the first thing to say is that people in the first century knew just as well as we do that dead people don't come back. If you read from Homer through Socrates to Plato to Pliny, whenever they mention the possibility of resurrection, they say, come on, as you say, give me a break. We know that doesn't. And the early Christians knew that just as well as we do. This is, again, part of this chronological snobbery thing. And this is a C.S. Lewis line about that. He says, you know, people often imagine that the ancients didn't know the laws of nature and that we now that we have modern science, we do. And he said, apropos the virgin birth, the reason that Joseph was worried about Mary's pregnancy was not because he didn't know where babies came from, but because he did. And the same with the resurrection. The disciples were not going around saying, oh, well, isn't that interesting? So people sometimes come back from the dead, you know. No, this was not one instance of what now appeared to be a new possible general rule or something. Far from it. Rather, this is a place where people often get confused. Because people say, oh, well, the Jews believed in resurrection, so when Jesus died, they naturally thought he'd come back. Well, no, most Jews of the time did believe in resurrection, but resurrection, they believed, was something that God would do for all his people at the end of time. Nobody ever imagined it would happen for one person in the middle. And you can test this because we know 100 years either side of Jesus, we know of several Jewish resistance movements, messianic movements, rebel movements. Routinely, they ended with the death of the founder, and we have in the histories of Josephus and so on accounts of what happened next. If the man you followed, who you believe is the king, the new leader, the one God has sent, etc., if he gets killed, you have a choice. Either you give up the movement, or you get yourself another leader. And we've got evidence of movements that do one or other of those things. In no case do we have people going around saying, actually, I think he's been raised from the dead. Because, you know, they were more hard-headed than that. They, you know, life is real. We've got to get on with it.
So just a quick recap of what Ed T. Wright was saying. Ancient people understood, just like modern people, that dead bodies stay dead. In some ways, ancient people understood this truth better than us modern people do, because they were more hard-headed than modern people are when it comes to death. And the reason for this is that they lived more intimately with death than we do. If you wanted meat for supper, you didn't go down to the local grocery store to get it. You didn't go to the local butcher shop. You went into your barn and you killed the animal that you wanted to eat. They had that immediacy in their dealing with death. Death was a part of the daily rhythm of life. If people in the ancient world died in their homes or in the homes of their children, there were no nursing homes or hospitals or hospices for old people to go to die. So death was an immediate and an intimate feature of life, and ancient people understood this very well. They knew that dead bodies stayed dead without exception. So any claim that someone had been resurrected from death to life, and to be clear, resurrection meant a tangible return of that person, a return to life from death, in a bodily and tangible manner, that kind of claim would have been met with incredible skepticism in the ancient world. But the challenge for the earliest church wasn't only that a resurrection of a person had taken place. That was hard enough to take to the world. The claim of early Christianity was that a crucified Messiah, a son of God, had died and been raised to new life. That was the message of the earliest church, the idea of a crucified and resurrected Jesus. It didn't develop over time. It was there from the very beginning of the witness of the earliest church to the world around them. From the very beginning, the church proclaimed a crucified and resurrected Messiah. It was on there it was on day one of the Christian religion. And we know this to be true because there are short creeds that Paul quotes in his letters that go back to the very beginning of the earliest church, right back to ground zero. The church from the very beginning proclaimed a crucified and resurrected Messiah Jesus. And that, that Christian claim evoked an extra level of skepticism in the Jewish world that it initially moved in. It provoked a huge skepticism in the Jewish world that the early church rose up in. Because Jewish people would have had great difficulty in accepting the idea of a crucified Messiah. It was an oxymoron concept. It absolutely made no sense. For instance, I have a quotation from Deuteronomy 21. It says this, and I have it on a slide. It says this: if someone guilty of a capital offense is put to death and their body is exposed on a tree, and a tree was a euphemism for a cross, you must not leave the body hanging on the tree overnight. Be sure to bury it that same day, because anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. What does that say about Jesus? He was crucified on a tree. You must not desecrate the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance by leaving that person up on the cross. He has to be taken down. Otherwise, you're desecrating the land that God gives you. And for the Jew, the notion that God's anointed one, his Messiah, could also be under God's curse was absurd. It was impossible. It was an oxymoron. Talking about a crucified Messiah was like talking about a married bachelor. It doesn't make any sense at all. And yet that's exactly what the earliest church proclaimed to the world, a crucified and resurrected Messiah. And in the broader culture, the idea of a son of God dying was impossible, especially by crucifixion. Walter Bauer, an important 20th century New Testament scholar, did extensive research on resistance in Jewish and Greek sources to the Christian claim about a crucified son of God. This is his quote. I got it on a slide there, Kevin. A God or son of God dying on a cross, that was enough to put an end to the new religion. And yet that's exactly what the earliest church, those first followers of Jesus, proclaimed to the world. They proclaimed a son of God dying on a cross. That should have been enough to put an end to that new religion. Jews believed in a final resurrection for people at the end of time. Greeks didn't believe in any kind of resurrection for anyone. The idea of a crucified criminal being resurrected in the middle of human history was ludicrous to both Jews and Gentiles. And my question to you is, why would those first followers of Jesus proclaim a message to the world around them that would run into such resistance, about as much resistance as you could imagine? You couldn't concoct a story that would have had as hard a time as the story about a crucified and resurrected Messiah, Son of God. It's like driving a car into a concrete wall. That's about as far as their message could be expected to go in their time. It ends where it starts, and it would be a brutal undertaking. Why would they do this? Especially if you think Christianity is an invented religion, that they made the whole thing up. Those first followers of Jesus, they could have chosen any story that they wanted. They had total freedom to concoct any story they wanted to make, yet they chose this one, the hardest one, a Messiah, Son of God, first crucified and then raised from the dead in a bodily and tangible manner. Who makes up that kind of story? A story that's going to be about the hardest story to tell others. A story that's going to get about the biggest possible resistance you could imagine from the world around you. Who's going to concoct a story and take it out into the world around them to share with others like this? It's like designing a product you know you can't sell, a product that no one wants, a product that no one can conceive of, a product that no one understands. And yet the followers of Jesus do exactly that. They take the most difficult, impossible story, and they boldly go out into that hostile world, and they unreservedly share it with others. And for me, at least, the only logical explanation that can make sense of all this, why the earliest church proclaimed from ground zero, from day one, about a crucified and resurrected Messiah, was that they believed it to be true. That's the only explanation that works for me personally. Those first disciples of Jesus carried the Jesus movement forward after his death because they believed that he had been raised from death to life. Why did they come to believe this? And the answer is that they say they met the risen Jesus, raised from the dead. They claim that they ate with him. They claim that they had been taught by him in his resurrected state. They claim to have touched him. They claim to have had a personal, first-hand experience with him, interacted with him on a first-hand basis in a very direct and tangible manner. The truth of what was happening in meeting Jesus again and again was undeniable to them. Jesus was crucified, but he's now raised. He was dead, but now he is alive in a real and intangible manner. And I can imagine someone perhaps saying something like, well, the earliest church didn't deliberately seek to deceive anyone. It's just how the story evolved over time. It picked up certain details along the way, like resurrection. But where did those first disciples of Jesus pick up this idea from? They were all Jews. They all knew that a crucified person couldn't be the Messiah, just as much as anyone else knew that. Once Jesus was crucified, it was over, as N.T. Wright was saying. It's over. It's done. Go home or find someone new. The notion of a crucified and resurrected Messiah is not something you just pick up. The only reason Jesus' first disciples came to believe that he had been raised to life was because it was forced upon them. They didn't have a choice. Once Jesus, raised from the dead, confronted them with the reality of his existence, it was settled for them. And they got stuck with this really tough story to sell to others. And it was just the way it was. And there wasn't much they could do about it, for better or for worse. And it seems to me that they must have done a pretty good job in overcoming the resistance of the world around them to their basic claim. Jesus crucified and now raised from the dead. Why do I say that? Well, because I know of a church in 2026 in Cambridge, Ontario, named Trillium that exists today. And it can only be existing today because their message managed to connect with people a long, long time ago. Almost 2,000 years ago, they took their message out into the world, and we are the deposit of their faith, their conviction, their testimony. They must have succeeded in their task of sharing the good news with others. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here today. And those first disciples took the story that was near impossible to share, and they managed to persuade many people that it was true, and it was by their conviction and their testimony and the quality of their life that came from it that changed the world. God's great rescue plan was taking hold. A new human being was being expressed through them, a new human nature, a new humanity rooted in joy and love and peace, along demonstrations of spiritual power, ultimately won the day out. And all along the way, throughout time, people have struggled to believe that Jesus, once crucified, was now truly raised to new life, raised from the dead into a new reality. And if you're struggling with this idea, and if you find yourself resisting this idea, or hesitating, or even hedging, then you are in good company. Even some of the disciples who met Jesus raised from the dead still struggled to believe after that, after they'd met him. After seeing him, even they struggled, because what we're dealing with ultimately is a miracle. So understand that you're not the first person or the last person who's going to struggle over Jesus' resurrection. And most of you are never going to find yourself permanently living in the land of total belief. You're not going to be 10 on that scale that I had showing you at the very beginning here. You're not going to live in that scale there. You're going to be moving up and down that continuum all the time in life, like the rest of us. Permanently living in the land of total belief, that's probably beyond any of us, really. But understand, God does not require your total belief in every moment of your life for his rescue plan to come to fruition through you. And that is the point. What God does require of us is that we act as if it's true. We live out our lives as if it is true, that Jesus is truly raised to new life. God calls us to build our lives as if Jesus were alive, no matter where we find ourselves along that continuum, whether at the bottom or at the top or somewhere in between, along the continuum, all we're asked to do is act as if Jesus is alive. That's enough for God's rescue plan to begin to work itself out through you. By the presence of the Holy Spirit, a new human nature will take hold in you. It doesn't require total, absolute belief in Jesus' resurrection. The reality of God's perfect love will begin to reveal itself through you as an extra blessing. And you will come to know through inner conviction just what the earliest church knew a long time ago, that Jesus is alive. Why? Because just as Jesus revealed himself to them, he will also reveal himself to you.